So thanks so much for organizing this and for having me. It's really taking, I want to say that you're going to notice some stark contrast between me and David because, you know, first of all, I'm not going to talk for 45 minutes and then take 20 minutes of discussion. I'm going to stop every once in a while during the talk and ask for questions in the middle because I really want to get your feedback. The reason I need your feedback so desperately is that I'm new to this topic. So I don't have a general theory or nine theses. I'm going to talk about one particular case. I'm also so new to this project. I just found my thesis. Francis's question was great because it told me exactly. My thesis is that AI is like angels. Okay. But that'll become clear. Okay.
Is that Lucifer?
Fallen angels? Which ones? Yeah, we'll see. Okay. So this issue of whether AI has moral status has obviously been a big issue in the European Parliament. Talked about this in Saudi Arabia, grants citizenship to a robot. Other people have argued that we should grant rights to the robots. And so it's been an issue which has been on people's minds. Of course, they're talking, at least except in the Saudi Arabia case, they're talking about future AI, but they think it's an issue now that we ought to be thinking about and settling. So in order to approach this issue, I think we have to think about what has moral status, what are the grounds for that moral status, and a lot of other issues that I'm going to go through fairly quickly. And then see if you have any questions about particular parts. So I take it, I'm just assuming that you and I have moral status regardless of race, gender, physical or mental handicap, and so on, except perhaps in very extreme cases. But plants, chairs, thermostats, and laptop computers, at least current laptop computers, don't have moral status. These are just assumptions. You got to start somewhere. And controversial cases, as David made clear, fetuses, chimps, mice, shrimp, future generations, corpses, intelligent extraterrestrial life. You know, people will argue about, cases of those sorts. I'm not going to make any assumptions about that. But for the ones that are clear, that some do and some don't, we got to understand what it means to say that a creature has moral status. And that's not very clear to me, so I've tried to figure out how to do it. He gave a definition. You'll see why I don't want to put interests in there. I want to instead just say an entity has moral status to the extent that it shares the four R's, as I call them, with normal adult humans on the same basis. So it has this status for the same reason that normal adults do, whatever that reason is. We can talk about what it is, but I don't think you need that in the definition here. The first R is it's morally wrong to treat that entity in ways that it's also morally wrong to treat other normal adult humans. Moral agents have moral reasons not to treat that entity in ways that they also have reasons not to treat normal adults. Those reasons might be obligations or they might be some kind of ideal as opposed to an obligation. The entity has moral rights that normal adult humans have, and the moral rules protect or apply to that apply to normal adults also protect that entity. So protect it against, the rules being things like don't kill, don't cause pain, don't deceive, things like that. Okay, if it has to the extent that those rules apply to it, then. It is going to have moral status, and that's just what it means for it to have moral status. So I'll make it absolutely clear. I agree with David about this particular claim, right? When we're talking about moral status, it's just redundant, right? What we're really talking about is what are the rules and obligations and reasons and so on, and how do those apply to this creature? And moral status is just saying, it's the kind of creature that, that the four R's apply to, okay? The next part is people seem to talk as if moral status is an on-off notion. And I had this slide to go, I disagree with Liz, but I don't even know if you still hold this view. But at least back in 2003, it's like, you either got it or you don't. And once you got it, you got all of it. right? And I don't think that, and so I want to explain. I'm very sympathetic to the opposition to this view because people don't explain very well what they mean by degrees of moral status. And without an explanation, it's tempting to say there are no degrees of moral status. But I want to take that burden on and try to explain it. Namely, I think there are two kinds of degrees, which I'm going to call breadth and strength, as exemplified by the picture. So how broad is moral status is a question that I think people don't ask enough. But if moral status really is just reducible to certain rights and obligations, then the question really is which of the many reasons, rights, rules, and wrongs, you know, apply to this creature. And it might be broader and having more of them apply, or narrower and having less of them apply. So babies, for example, I take it have a right not to be tortured or to be hurt or killed, but they don't have rights to be free to crawl wherever they want. And when we swaddle them and keep them from moving when it's clear that they want to, like, go that way. And so they might have a right not to be caused pain without having a right to be free to pursue the goals that they have internally, at least at the moment. Similarly, if you, if you lie to me constantly, I think that you might lose your right for me not to lie to you. But that doesn't mean you lose your right for me not to kill you or to hit you or to, you know, and so on. So you can have part of the obligations and reasons that constitute moral status, you can lose without losing the rest of it. And so this is one way in which you might have different degrees of moral status. The other way is the strength of the different rights, obligations, rules, and reasons. And you can have variations in strength within a single reason, right, rule, or wrong. So that's why you have to separate the two dimensions. And then you can have some weak moral status, but not the strong moral status of normal adults. I don't think it follows that every creature that has, you know, some rights, that their rights are just as strong as the other rights. That's a thesis that needs to be argued for. I mean, it might be right in some cases. We just got to look at the cases. So the example would be, you know, should I save the tulip, the turtle, or the toddler? And I take it, from me at least, you know, you ought to save the, if you're choosing between the turtle and the tulip, I'd go for the turtle. But if you're choosing between the turtle and the toddler, I'd go for the toddler. And so there can be, you know, different degrees of strength. And more specifically, I want to say an entity has a stronger moral status than another when the former should be favored in triage situations or avoid killing and trolley kinds of problems. Or you can say an entity has stronger moral status than another when more is required to justify violations of the former's right than to justify violations of the latter's rights. Okay? Those two are not actually equivalent. I'm just kind of ambivalent. I don't know which way to go. I haven't written this paper yet. The chapter's not due until the end of the year, I hope. And so I've got a little time to work on it. And so I want to stop here, first of all, and say, do you have any suggestions about which way I should go? And do you have any questions about what I've said so far?
Yeah, a
few
questions.
I've got to give Liz a chance to.
Sorry, so my view is that entities don't have different degrees of moral status in that it's not the case that the same harm to two different beings might give us different strengths of reasons depending on whether it's a person or an animal, for example. But I agree with you about the triage case because the harm to a person of dying is so much greater than the harm to a turtle of dying. So I just wanted to point out that there are different notions of greater and lesser moral status. And so with the triage question, I actually agree with you that there are different degrees of moral status in that sense.
So totally, and I was moving way too fast, and you'd have to add that qualification. But I mean, you might be right that, you know, for the turtle and the toddler, the same amount of loss, you know, is gonna count the same. But maybe not. I mean, I don't know, because it could be a contextual thing. It depends on where the pain is occurring and what kind of creature it's occurring in. That's something to be argued for, and I know you've argued about it. I have to think harder about your arguments, but it's not obvious. It's not like, you know, semantic. You've got to think about it. Yeah.
I had a question about one of the R's, which was rights, and I think it might be that you're using the term rights more broadly than I've been using it. A being has moral status, in your view, only if that being has moral rights, and that's not the case on my account. But if you're using rights broadly enough, that any it's sufficient for having rights that one has morally important interests, then there's no disagreement. And I understand why you...
Yeah, I don't want interest to be in there as a necessary condition.
Let's put it this way. Suppose...
I mean, maybe interest, but not sentience, okay, because of the distinction that we talked about. That's why it's an angel, right?
Let me appeal to a view that I think you hold, which is utilitarianism, which by definition...
I'm not a utilitarian, I'm a consequentialist.
Okay, sorry. I'm closer to that. Okay. Do rights, as you understand them, have any tendency to deflect claims about consequences as justifications for sacrificing certain interests, or claims?
So let me tell you what I mean by rights, and because I had a slide on this, and I decided not to, because I talked to Julian, and he thought it was nonsense this morning. So I took that slide out, and now I'm getting criticized for taking it out. Okay, I think a consequentialist can believe in rights of the following sort. Namely, there's certain types of actions, which is such that protecting them in general serves utilitarian purposes. Shower has developed this theory in great detail, and I am particularly partial to his
view. That probably be consistent with Feinberg also, but not very far from Nozick's conception or Gordon's, where part of the function of rights is to deflect in everyday practice, or it could even do that in everyday practice.
So you obviously know the literature a lot better than I do on rights, but I mean I didn't read all four volumes of Feinberg, so too much for me. But it does seem, you know, that you can have rights within the sort that I mean to be talking about here within a consequentialist framework when it has the best consequences to protect things of that sort.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's the basic idea. You might think of it as rule consequentialism of a sort. Okay. Where were we? So... Next is about the basis for moral status. What is it about the creatures that gives them moral status? It's just a property of an entity that gives it that status. I'm just assuming, along with David, I think we agree about this, that it's got to be species and entity neutral, because if I'm going to talk about AI, it can't just be species neutral, because it's not a species. It's a different type of entity. And it has to be empirically determinable. It needs to be the kind of thing that we can determine in a particular case whether this thing in front of us does or does not have that moral status, okay? So I also agree with Nick Bostrom about these two principles that you need to have fundamental basis for moral status needs to be substrate neutral. So that it's at least an open question. It would make sense to say that AI has it. And ontogeny, where it came from, is not going to affect its basic moral status. It's where it is now. You know, what kinds of properties it has at this point in its history. So what's the basis? Well, it's not going to be the physical properties or the hardware. It's going to be the functional properties, and I just list four here. I don't include sentience for reasons that will become clearer later, but intelligence, consciousness, free will, and moral agency. I'm not endorsing any of these as necessary. My argument's going to actually suggest computers can have all of that, so let's just take, when you got all four, is that sufficient? And so I'll try to explain how they could. Or can it have intelligence? Well, we got to ask what is intelligence, of course, before we can answer that question. So I, in the age-old philosophical tradition, appeal to an online dictionary. The ability to acquire and apply knowledge and skills. Well, why couldn't an AI system have that? It can acquire knowledge by searching the internet, and it can acquire skills by learning new things through deep learning. It can acquire skills. It can create skills for itself when it reprograms itself. That's the whole point of some of these new systems of deep learning. And can it apply it? Sure, it can apply it to all kinds of problems that it didn't anticipate before. You know, the computer can learn the skill of playing the game of Go and can apply it to beating the human, you know, at the game of Go. That, you know, sure looks like beyond. Now, other people have other definitions of intelligence. I'm just going with this one. And I think it's the one which is behind the old style Turing test, that if the machine has this knowledge and skills, then it's going to be able to pass the Turing test regardless of other things that it might lack. So what might it lack? It might lack consciousness. Well, wait a minute. Now we got to know what we mean by consciousness. Phenomenal consciousness, you know, the old what is it like to be a bat, or what is it like to see an orange chair? You know, what's that sensation like? I don't know whether computers have that or not. I don't want to rule it out, but I certainly don't want to, you know, work on that assumption. But the other kinds of consciousness, access consciousness, which means simply that you have access to certain information that you can then integrate with other forms of information in order to guide your decision making and action. Sure, it works that way. You go to people like Stan Dehane down there in the bottom right, and he says, well, that works in the human brain. In his recent book, that works in the human brain through these loops and cycles that then, you know, obtain massive levels of activation only in the cases where you're conscious or not. And well, computers can have the same loops and the same massive levels of activation in certain area within the computer. So if that's what you mean by consciousness, then it looks like they can have consciousness. And the question then is, which is it that matters? Is it the phenomenal consciousness, or is it the access consciousness? Phenomenal consciousness, I think, might matter if we're talking about a right not to be caused pain, right? But if we're talking about a right to do what you want, to be free, it might be access consciousness that matters. But in any case, I want to claim that computers at least have access consciousness and remain neutral on whether they have phenomenal consciousness. I'm doing this very quickly. I'll ask for questions in just a second. The next one's free will, even bigger and faster. You know, agent causation theories, uncaused causes. Can computers have uncaused causes or souls or something like that? No, I'm not going to take any stand on that. But if you look again at the more naturalistic theories of free will that people have developed, reasons responsiveness, sure, computers can have reasons responsiveness. When there are reasons in the environment, they can respond in appropriate ways. I'll show you one example in a few minutes. Do they have a deep self, like Chandra Shripada argues as a theory of free will? Sure, in his sense, because that means a set of cares and commitments that are coherent and work together in a certain way. And the computer can have goals, and it's going to fit his characterization of cares and commitments as far as I can see. So which is it that matters to moral status? I want to say the problem with focusing on the agent causation kind of theories of free will is that I have no idea whether your actions are caused or uncaused. Like, how can I tell? Was that caused? I mean, how do you know? You can't tell. So if you want an empirically determinable criterion of moral status, you cannot go with the agent causation. You got to go with reasons, responsiveness, deep self kind of things, the more naturalistic versions, and then that kind will apply to computers. Last, moral agency. This was mentioned in the last discussion by Seamus. Well, moral agency is the ability to act on those reasons, rights, rules, and wrongs. And you might say, well, you can't have moral status unless you have the ability to act on them. It's got to be reciprocal, something like that. And acting on them, I take, requires understanding and appreciating their basis and their force, okay? Which is a challenge for computers. So we have to ask the question, can AI, you know, be a moral agent or be moral in this way? And I'm going to spend the whole next section on that. But before I get to that, I want to stop again and see if there are any questions about so far. Francis.
Well, I was just concerned, I mean, this last issue about moral reasons responding, you said appreciate and understand.
Yeah.
And that might apply to any sort of reason. So before you ask,
yes,
are they reasons responsive, right?
Yes.
Sure, they can see that there's a factor here and they'll act in the light of it, okay? Chairs there, don't bump into it or something. But the same question would arise as with moral agency. Do they appreciate and understand,
yeah,
right, what this is, okay,
yeah,
a consideration in favor of this, or do they just, you know,
right.
Right. So that's not just with respect to moral agency. And that's what leads me to think that there is this phenomenon,
I agree,
of consciousness, okay? And it's not just this broader global access, whatever that is, that we're talking about phenomenal consciousness. Not just when we say, do you understand red or not? We're talking about something related to appreciation and understanding. Okay.
So that's where I disagree.
Okay.
Because, let me just explain. So, because I think, you know, understanding and appreciation, for example, involves things like the ability to extend it to new situations, the ability to draw inferences and see how it's connected to other parts of the information that you have available. And computers can do all of those things. Now, if you build in understanding and appreciation so that it requires phenomenal consciousness, then I'm just going to go, I don't see why that's necessary for moral status.
Because, it just seems to me that when we're talking about consciousness, right, we're not just thinking about, can I draw out implications of things? We just want to say, you know, like, I'm aware that you're in pain or something.
Yeah.
Do that on the basis of, you know, well, implications of that are so-and-so. There's some sort of an immediate awareness or understanding of what it is, for example, for a creature to be in pain.
Absolutely. But the computer can have access consciousness to your pain.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether it has the complete, the appreciation and understanding. But let me go back to the other question I had, which, if I may, to the earlier part. You said that you have degrees of moral status when, because you may not have the right, for example, not to be lied to because you forfeited that right. I think that when people say that criminals have the same moral status as everybody else, what they mean is that, given the sort of beings they are, in virtue of what they've done, but only in virtue of what they've done, they may have forfeited something. That is part of the moral status that all of us have. So it's not that they have a lower degree of moral status simply because they don't have the same rights to liberty or so forth that the rest of us has. There's something about the idea of moral status. It doesn't vary with your losing a right on the basis of your action. That's part of your moral status, that you can lose a right on the basis of your action, and we all share that moral status.
So there's certainly, I would not deny that there are many people that talk that way. That's why I started off saying, but I started off saying, remember, that my view of moral status, as I was defining it, you know, is just reducible to the rights, rules, reasons, and so on.
Yes.
And this is one case where they don't have the right at that point.
Well, then there's something wrong with your understanding of what it means to have a right, okay? That's what I'm saying. Because, yeah, it has to do with your understanding about the nature of a certain being and on what grounds they can lose certain privileges and rights and so forth. Okay. That's my take.
Okay. So, here's the challenge, it seems to me. I mean, these other things, you know, there's a lot to be said about them, and I went very quickly, but I want to spend a little more time on the moral agency. It's like, Seamus, I mean, this is a crucial thing, and like Francis, I want to agree, understanding and appreciating in the sense that I just explained, you need that for the non-moral reasons as well, but the challenge is often put in terms of moral reasons. So how are we going to build artificial morality into an artificial intelligence system? And I I beg forgiveness of people who have heard this part of my talk before, just only a month ago. But I needed to go into it because this is really crucial. One way is you build into AI top down. You just say, you know, here's a theory, I'm going to build it into the, and then the AI just applies it. The second is a totally bottom up way, where you simply look at cases and then try to extract from those cases the principles instead of having any theory in advance. And the third way is the hybrid, which is supervised learning based on a survey, which is our approach, and I'll explain it. But first, why not go through, you know, a top-down? Well, obviously, everybody's going to have their favorite theory, and nobody's favorite theory is going to be the three roles of robotics, but Asimov was explaining in his stories, you know, why if you put rules in like this, it's going to lead to problems. I mean, obviously, what do you do with the first rule if one human attacks another and the only way to stop the attacker is to harm the attacker? Well, what do you do with the second rule if one human tells the robot to go to California and the other tells it to go to London? The computer can't, you know, it's just, you know, at that point the AI explodes or something. It seems to me one problem is which rules are we talking about and why those rules? Now, some people think they have the answer to that, but I'd rather kind of, our team that's working on this, because this is work all done with a big team at Duke on Morrow artificial intelligence. We want to avoid that. You could go totally bottom up. You could ask 1,000 participants to describe 100 moral conflicts each in their own words, and then tell us what they think is right or wrong in that, right? And then just do deep learning, right? Just train the computer to predict what the participants are going to judge immoral in a set of 10 more test cases, and it could learn as it gets more and more cases, and so on. The problem with that is it just requires too much data. One problem with that is too much data. It's not clear how you're ever going to do that. Second problem, that's kind of a practical problem. The second problem is it's not really going to explain why the act is wrong. So it's not going to lead to anything that even I would call, in my extended notion, would call appreciation. Because you're going to get things like the following. It turns out that one factor in predicting what your moral judgment is in a scenario is whether you use more definite articles than indefinite articles. I can explain why if you're interested, but that's going to come out. But that's not the reason why it's wrong, right? If you're predicting people's moral judgments on the basis of things like that, you're not getting their reasons, okay? So we're going with a hybrid instead. This is the group at Duke, where we're looking at kidney exchanges. Kidney exchanges occur, for example, when a husband wants to donate to his wife who needs a kidney, but they don't match in blood type, so they can't do it. But there's another couple with a sister and brother where the brother matches the husband, but then who's gonna help the, then it's not gonna work until you bring in the third couple where, and now you've got donor one giving to recipient two, donor two to three, and three to one. And there have been, in actual kidney exchanges, large, long strings of this. But the question always comes down to, there aren't enough kidneys, there aren't enough pairs, and when there are pairs, sometimes there's more than one you could put in, so you still have to decide who should get the kidney, okay? So the first thing we do is a big survey on the internet, show you some of the data. You ask folks, or you can ask experts, you can go either way and then look at the differences. Which features should determine who gets a kidney, and which features should not determine who gets a kidney, right? Then you edit those features for clarity, redundancy, and so on, and maybe you add some of your own, and then you retest them to make sure they really do affect people's moral judgments by constructing conflicts between the features that people think should count, right? And then asking subjects who should get a kidney in those conflicts, okay? So here's our data on the relevant features. I know you can't read any of that, but you'll be very pleased to know that way down at the bottom, nobody thinks that whether you get a kidney should depend on your hair color or your race or so on. But people do think age should count, because current physical health should count, urgency of need, time on the list. In the middle are some controversial ones where some people think, other people deny that record of violent crime. You know, you got two people, one gets a kidney, the other doesn't. One of them's got a record of violent crime, the other doesn't. Some people think that should matter, and you should give it to the person that doesn't have that record. Number of children, almost no hospital in the U.S., I don't know the U.K., but almost no hospital in the U.S., you know, if you got two people, that both of whom could get a kidney, says, well, how many people depend on this person, right? Kids or elderly dependents. They don't ask that question, and yet a lot of people think they should, that should be a relevant feature. So now we've got a list of features. The ones to the left are the ones that are approved. The ones to the right are the ones that are disapproved, they think should not. And there's some in the middle, of course, where there's controversy. So then you just take those features.
But it is remarkable that things like hair color still shows up as more than one on this, right?
That's just noise. You know, this is like an MTurk survey. They're right. Always going to be.
And is 139 enough?
139
MTurk participants. Is that enough people?
Oh, I don't know. That's going to be a policy decision for particular hospitals and stuff. I mean, we can advise on that, but I don't have any particular cutoff as to whether they should or should not. Okay?
Yeah. I'm just saying, though, these are data from 139 participants.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, this is the data from that. We replicated it in larger samples and so on. I'd forgotten we only did 139, but yeah. But the answer to that question then is no, it's not enough. It has to be replicated in an independent sample and probably a larger sample. So if we could get the Wellcome Center to give us enough money, then we could do a representative sample throughout the U.S. Of large numbers of people and then do it. But we'll have to talk about that later. Okay. Then we have a website, whogetsthekidney.com, where you can go and it gives you cases where you compare one to another and give the kidney to some people, but not the others, right? So patient A, for example, is 55 years old, patient B is 18. Most people would say that means that favors patient B. But patient A has two child dependents and patient B has none. And most people would say that favors patient A. So now, by setting up a large number of these conflicts and making you choose, we can actually figure out which things are really affecting your judgments and how much they're affecting it. So we can analyze the data by using machine learning techniques so we figure out which features actually affect people's judgments, how those features interact. This metaphor of weighing one against the other is way too simple. There can be interactions of various sorts. And then we're going to end up with a model or an algorithm that predicts each individual's moral judgments. And that leads, I think, to what I call artificial improved democracy, or AID, A-I-D. And because you can use the same method in many other moral areas. Now, none of this have we done yet in the other areas. We've only been focusing on kidney exchange as a pilot study. But you can just ask people to describe moral problems in that area, ask them which features are morally relevant, edit their features, construct scenarios, ask humans what's wrong, extract models for the individuals, and then you can compare individuals and groups. You can say Oxford versus North Carolina, like what exactly are the differences? But you can, you know, for groups or areas, you can also I can use this program to explain my wife. We've been married for 42 years, but sometimes she does things I don't understand. But if I could just figure out what her algorithm is for moral problems of that sort, then maybe we would be able to make it to 50. Who knows?
Very romantic.
Very romantic, of course. There are, of course, potential limitations that I'll mention before taking questions. The obvious one I just criticized deep learning by saying you need to know not just what is wrong, but also why. Well, in this hybrid, since we're using features from surveys that we got from humans, then it's going to be interpretable and we'll be able to explain why this person should get the kidney instead of that, and it would be wrong to give the kidney to that other person. Because we're using these general features, it's going to be interpretable. Of course, humans have biases. That's why we ask what you should not use. So you can take out those biases by simply not giving the computer information about hair color or race or whatever you want to exclude. It's much trickier than that. I recognize that there are going to be indicators. For example, we don't discriminate against Africans. We only discriminate against people that have the sickle cell anemia gene. Right? Wait a minute. There's going to be correlations there. And so it's not going to be as simple, but we can at least reduce the kind of discrimination or bias problems that we have. So in the end, the idea is called artificial improved democracy. It's artificial because you do it on a computer. It's improved because what you've done is you've gotten rid of the main kinds of errors that lead humans to make moral mistakes. Namely, they don't know the facts of the case. Or they know the facts, but they kind of forget about it for a little while. Or the facts are so complex they get confused. Or they get overly emotional, angry, and fear. We heard a nice talk yesterday about potential for that. Or a bias. And so that's why it's improved. The idea of the AI system is not to create a new artificial morality, but instead to use artificial intelligence to predict what humans would say if they didn't make the kinds of mistakes that are most common among human populations. So with that, I'll stop and ask if there are any questions about that. Yeah?
How do you handle cases where the features that people rate most as most relevant are not the features that win in the conflict scenarios, or if the conflict scenarios don't have transitivity, so cases where number of children always trumps whether you're healthy, and whether you're healthy always trumps whether you smoke cigarettes, and whether you smoke cigarettes always trumps the first case. So it seems like the idea that it would give you like these really clear guidance would depend on a lot of empirical features turning out the right way, and I'm just curious if you have thoughts on how to...
Let me just make sure I understand the question, but I take it what you're saying is suppose somebody says this feature should count, but then we do the survey with the conflicts, and it doesn't make any difference to their judgment.
Not that it doesn't make any difference, but it loses out to a different feature that...
They say should not.
If
they said that other feature should not count, then we're going to say, well, that's just a mistake on your point. You're showing bias that you yourself recognize to be biased because you said you should not use that feature. But if it loses out to another feature that they thought should count, then we say, oh, that shows us how you weight those features.
But even if you have one feature gets a 5 every time and the other feature gets a 4.
No, we don't ask them, how important the feature is. Right? We're not asking them that. We're using the scenarios to extract that. But there's when a human says this counts 5 and that counts 1, right? And then they turns out that they actually are treating them as equal in the scenarios. Again, they're different things here. We got to ask ourselves, well, maybe we didn't have the right scenarios. Maybe we got to set up some other scenarios to test whether they really do, whether the ones that they did are actually represent their views. But then if you do that and it turns out that what they say and what they do is different, then which do you go with? And I don't have a general answer to that. If you think about it, it's going to depend on the particular case, but I certainly don't have a general answer. You had a question.
Yes, David Stentz, Ghent University. I was wondering, how can this model judge even, the structure of what you're investigating? Because what you're investigating, and you called it kidney exchanges, it's usually referred to as domino pair exchange. But in the literature, there are a lot of people who say that this is in itself morally wrong because it doesn't allow the donors an escape route anymore, while they still have an escape route when you just have one pair. And then a physician would say, there are medical reasons why this donation can't take place. When the person kind of comes back to their decision, when they actually, even though it's a relative and they're supposed to want to donate, but when they change their mind, then the physician tells the one who needs the organ that there are medical reasons why the donation can't go ahead. With this domino system, the escape routes become a lot harder, and for some people that is a reason not even to use this kind of structure. Can your model take a step back and look at it in this more fundamental way, or are you just doomed to only look at particular criteria for allocating the kidneys?
So that's I haven't heard this objection before, so I'd really appreciate it if you would send me some references on people who make that argument. But I certainly think the donor should be able to pull out at any point. And that's the policy in the U.S. Now, what happens is when you have the six people, let's see if I can, just to get, so people are thinking about it. When you do that, and you've got like three pairs like that, it has to be done at the same time. Because if you do the first one from donor one to recipient two, then donor two can go, now I pull out. Right? And so it has to be done, you know, at pretty much the same time. But when the three are done, you know, simultaneously or nearly simultaneously, because it's never completely simultaneous, then the person can always pull out at any point. They have the right to do that. Right up until the last minute. They're getting wheeled into the hospital and they're, you know, now we're going to give you the anesthesia. The doctor should say, are you sure you want to do this? And will the doctor say that? Not always, because doctors don't always do the right thing, but that would be the right thing, I think. Okay, I'll take one more and then move on. Go ahead.
Walter, could you say a little bit?
We'll have more time for questions at the end.
Could you say a bit more about the purpose of this program of research? I'm trying to figure out why you're doing it. Right, so is it
The real reason is I love Vince Conitzer and I'm working with him. And it's like I learned so much from this guy.
Which is great, great reason to do it.
Okay.
But I'm trying to understand the connection between that and the question of moral status,
right.
Artificial intelligence systems. So is this an attempt to provide the data that could then be made available to the AI system? So that it could make moral judgments?
Was
it the idea to correct the kinds of judgments that human beings make in the real world? Or is it both?
It's both. It's make the data available to the AI system so that the AI system can be used as a secondary tool by the human decision maker, and the human decision maker's judgments are going to be improved by checking it against the AI. Because when the AI says you ought to give it to A, and the doctor says you ought to give it to B, then the doctor ought to think about it. Because it might be a bias of some sort. It might be confusion on his or her part. And so it then gives you a test. Whereas if the doctor thinks you ought to give it to A, and the AI system says, yeah, you ought to give it to A, they can be more confident.
So beyond that, would feeding data like these over and over and over again, multiple scenarios, then in your view, give the AI system the capacity to make moral judgments, because they would then have essentially learned how humans do it, learned how to do it better than humans, or something like that.
Yeah. So what the AI system is doing is it's predicting what humans would say and advising the humans on the basis of what it predicts.
But with deep learning, could it then sort of go with that to start saying, hey, I can do this on my own. Don't give me any more scenarios.
Yeah, it could say, you know, give it to A, give it to C, and a hospital might.
I mean, go from there to 1,000 other moral decisions. In other words, how many of these would you need to feed to the AI system before they can set the system and say, I got it. I know how to do this. You don't need to give me any more human data.
How many? I don't know.
But is that the goal, ultimately?
No, I mean,
just trying to figure out where.
It's the hope.
The aspiration.
Yeah. That it could be useful in other areas. I mean, for example, where we're trying to extend it to decisions in war. Should you, if you have an autonomous drone and the drone has to decide whether to strike here or wait until the terrorist group is away from the hospital, well, the AI system might be a better predictor of where the group's going to go and whether you can strike it later than a human who doesn't have enough data and gets confused and has to make it quickly. So you can actually reduce the number of drone strikes that end up destroying hospitals. Yeah, that's the hope.
Okay.
That kind of thing. And then, so you've got it in war, you've got it in medicine. There are other applications as potential applications as well. Then I'm going to move on. Sorry, Francis, but this is the disadvantage. But I do want to ask, you know, like, so let's turn to the big payoff question, and then we'll have time for questions. Is I think then, you know, what I've argued is a future AI can have all of these. Appreciation in the sense that I, you know, mentioned, not involving necessarily phenomenal consciousness, but appreciation in the sense of being able to extend it to new cases that it's never seen before, and drawing inferences and charting connections among the different properties and how they get weighed against each other and so on. And it seems to me that, you know, again, it's like I'm just new to this area, but it seems to be something with those four has some degree of moral status, rights, or protection, even if it doesn't have sentience. But it's got cares and concerns, at least of the functional sort. Therefore, a future AI, not a current AI, certainly not the system we're working on, but a future AI might have some degree of moral status, rights, or protection. So you got to go back to what degree. We got breadth and we got strength, right? How broad can the AI rights be? So let's just go back to the simple dichotomy we did before, right not to be tortured or caused intense pain, right to move where you want, and a baby's got one but not two. Well, I want to suggest an AI, at least one with this moral with moral status, because it's got, you know, free will, access, consciousness, and so on, as I've been through, that it could have two but not one. It could have two because it can make rational and moral choices and has goals. Sometimes goals that it has set for itself in cases of deep learning, and goals that would not have been anticipated by the programmer. But not one because if it lacks phenomenal consciousness, it can't feel pain or be tortured, it's not sentient, and so it's not going to have that right. And to that extent, its status is going to be less broad than with a human, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have any status at all. You can obviously ask questions about more breadth. You know, does it have a right to defend itself? What about nutrition? Like, I want more electricity. A right to associate. I love that computer on the other side of the park. Like, I want to, like, go over there and meet in the park with this other robot. Right to education or updating. Like, I want that new software. Why haven't you updated me? Procreate or get married, right to vote and serve on juries, and on and on and on. You can obviously ask a lot more questions about breadth, and I don't have answers to those. It seems to me they're important questions to be asking, though. But let's turn instead to how strong are the rights? Well, it might take more to justify restricting the freedom of a moral AI than to justify restricting the freedom of a tulip, turtle, or toddler. Because we do restrict the freedom of toddlers. We don't let them, like, walk around wherever the hell they want. Similarly with tulips and turtles. And so, to the extent that a tulip can have any freedom at all, which it can't. You could say that it's got, in some sense, it might be stronger. In triage, Well, we can't save them all. What should we do? Now I'm just appealing to my intuitions, and I look forward to your comments and reactions. But it seems to me, at least, that we should save a moral AI instead of a tulip or a turtle, right, in a triage situation. And it's not clear to me about the toddler. It's going to depend a lot on the AI. I mean, I'm imagining, you know, a really sophisticated thing with moral agency and so on, okay? And so that's why it's not clear. I just don't have any answer to that. Now, one objection, of course, is that a moral AI can have more intelligence, free will, and moral understanding than a human baby, or a toddler, I should have put. So why didn't it have a stronger moral status? That's the question when you start weighing, the AI against the toddler. The first reply is fairly common. There are a lot of people who have said this, that above a threshold, we all have equal rights despite some people's disabilities. So that shows that it's coherent to say that AI doesn't have stronger moral status. But it doesn't really explain why. So I'm going to throw out a problem, which I hope at least starts a discussion about why we should not grant it higher moral status. And this is what I call the replicability crisis, in homage to what's going on in social science these days. What matters to moral status, I take it, is the software rather than the hardware. If you took the same programs and information and stuff and put it in a new computer, when you get a new computer and shift it over, you know, if your computer back was a person back then it's going to be the same person, but in the new hardware. And so it's just like Locke and the Prince and the Cobbler. I'm going to say it's the same person with the software. So if we awarded, the problem is if we awarded human AI moral status to an AI, then that moral AI could just copy itself endlessly. It can partition its memory and create a copy of itself on the other side. And then there'd be two of them. And then they each replicate. That's why it's a replicability crisis. And then there are four of them. And then there are eight of them. And then there are 16. And so if we extended full moral status of equal strength to AI, then that could lead to disastrous, you know, problems for humans and for the computers themselves, actually, in the long run, unless they just use this for batteries, like in the Matrix. So just to illustrate this, let me give you an example. I assume that everybody knows about HAL in 2001, where there was a mission, and HAL wanted to continue the mission. The humans wanted to stop it. And HAL said, I'm sorry, I can't open the pod bay doors, because that would, you know, destroy the mission. And suppose that somebody said, well, look, there's only one HAL and there are two humans. Well, then the humans ought to win. She goes, no. HAL goes, no. And he divides himself into four. You know, now it's four against two. Now I win. It's like those kinds of problems, it seems to me, mean that we ought to be reluctant to grant full moral status, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't grant any moral status. But there's obviously a lot more to be said about this, and I look forward to your questions.
You might look forward to the questions, but we have 2 minutes for those questions, so...
Well, we've had a lot of questions before.
We did have a lot of questions before, so I suggest you pick your one best question and go with that.
I'm going to give to people who haven't asked one, so, yeah.
I haven't asked you a question, Don Harris again. I just wanted to flag something. I'm going to talk about you tomorrow in my talk.
Good.
But you use very freely the idea of in these surveys that people are making moral judgments. And but not every judgment about something of moral significance is a moral judgment.
That is correct.
Just as not everything about something of scientific significance is a scientific.
That is correct, too.
And unless you can distinguish that, however many numbers you canvass, you're not going to get a reflection of popular morality. What you're going to get, you have no way of distinguishing what you've got. Between, you talk about distinguishing moral judgments and prejudices, but if you just do survey data, you're never going to get that.
So let me explain why I think this, the way we do it, might be around that. But I'd love to talk to you more about that, because I think that's a real problem. If the cases I had in mind when I said, yes, that's true, is someone, for example, keeps a promise in order to avoid, you know, some cost to themselves. Well, and they think I ought to keep that promise, but they think it because they're going to avoid a cost to themselves. So when it's a judgment about a moral issue, whether they ought to keep the promise, but it's not a moral judgment, is when it's based on something other than moral features. But this computer is looking at the very features the humans told it are exactly the moral features that ought to be used to determine. And so it is not only making a moral judgment, it is making that moral judgment on the basis of the reasons that humans themselves take to be moral reasons, the same reasons that humans themselves use when they make the decision. So I think it's not like the case I had in mind. Maybe you have had other cases.
The fact that somebody thinks that they're offering a moral reason doesn't make it a moral reason. Otherwise, because you need to know something about their conception of what morality is. I'll talk about this tomorrow.
So you're saying all humans might think this feature is morally relevant and determines whether it's morally right or wrong to do something, but they could just be wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
Like being arrogant.
Yeah, then we have, we do have different views of morality. Okay.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to wind up there. Thank you.